You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You are now entering the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast, a show that uncovers what's fact, what's fake, and what's fun in the crazy world of pseudo-archaeology. Hello and welcome to the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast, episode 181. And tonight, we talk about the book Skull Wars and why I'm going to stop using it, even though it's a very good book. So, hey guys, welcome back. It is nice to be here. And I thought that I would discuss the book Skull Wars today. And you're like, what? What's that? What's going on? This has just been on my mind recently because in one of my classes, this is a book that came out in 2000, written by David Hurst Thomas. And it, on the surface, seems like it's about the Kennewick Man controversy. And it is. It does talk about that. It's kind of the impetus for the book. But the book actually overall goes much deeper into sort of the history of archaeology in North America and kind of the relationship between archaeologists and native people, if that makes sense. And I really just like its style. I like the way it does the story, the way it sets it out, because I think David Hurst Thomas does a great job of hitting the middle ground, which is very difficult. It's not a book that's like all on the archaeologist side, but it's also not a total utter like apologist book of how archaeology is always bad. And, you know, the sort of quote unquote, the native side is always right. You know, I think it does a great job. And hey, the book's 26 years old. And so if I'm talking it up about how great it is, you're like, Kinkella, then why are you going to stop using it for your classes? It sounds pretty good. Well, two things happened. First, what's funny is I was putting together all the materials for my class and I realized I'd actually forgotten to add the book. And I had everything else ready, right? The syllabus and the other books and materials and stuff. And I'm like, oh, crap. But then I was like, wait, should I add it? And I looked a little closer and I actually ultimately decided not to. And to do stuff like this, I talked about this on my YouTube channel a bit too. Same kind of thing, because I wanted to at least have kind of an overview of this book for my students so they could at least listen to the main arguments. And one of the many things that makes this book so great is it brings up all kinds of great stuff for us to argue about, you know, or have a gray area about, if that makes sense. This book is no fun if you just take an extreme side and is like, you know, archaeologists are always right, and that's just how it is. Or the native community is just always right, and that's how it is. It's like, no, it's fun to kind of go point by point and think about, right, the facts of each aspect and, you know, what's the right way forward, because it's super complicated, right? But again, okay, so why are you not using it? And it's, you know, it's mainly because there's a big portion on the dating of the earliest humans into the New World. And hey, man, this book is 26 years old. So a lot of the dating stuff is old, right? We found a bunch of much better sites for earliest dates for North America. And the earliest dates have been reliably pushed back some. And so going over that, you know, using this book, it's old. And also even with the Kennewick Man case has gone forward and other stuff has happened. And, you know, I just have to tell you guys that David Hurst Thomas, he just couldn't see the future. So whatever, man. Anyway, I thought I would just go over it and talk about some of these themes and talk about kind of, you know, where they've gone and my take on some of this. The book itself starts out in the intro. This is interesting. David Hurst Thomas has Vine Deloria Jr. come and do the intro. And a lot of stuff that Vine Deloria talks about, I actually disagree with, right? He's pretty extreme. This is a native guy who denies like the Bering land bridge idea, you know, and he's, for my money, really anti-science. And that's where I kind of draw the line, right? So he stokes the argument sometimes in a bad way. He stokes the idea that archaeologists and the native community are on opposite sides of the spectrum. And in my experience, we're totally not, right? I've worked with native people, I think, for, I don't know, man, the better part of 30 years now, at least a solid 20 plus. And what I find is actually that native people and archaeologists, 95% of the time, are in the same camp, and it's us versus big business, or it's us versus development, right? That's the cleavage point. You know, it's not, oh, archaeologists and natives are never get along, and do, because we're on the same page so often, because really it's archaeologists and native people who care, while often everyone else doesn't. So I find that argument that archaeologists and native people are at odds old, even old for the time, even old in 2000. But there's no reason to sort of fakely stoke that or fight a battle that's 80 years old, you know. And I do find that Vine Deloria does do that. But I think it was pretty ballsy for David Hirst Thomas to have him do the intro. And it's kind of fun. And even though I disagree with all kinds of stuff that Vine Deloria says, it's fun. It starts with talking in that gray area. Anyway, he moves on and, of course, talks about Kennewick Man. Now, in 2000, Kennewick Man is going to be big news, because Kennewick Man was found in 1996. And this is a set of human remains that end up being like 9,300 years old, right? It's one of the oldest and best preserved human bodies, you know, found in the Americas. And there was a battle between archaeologists and native groups over its sort of who owns the past, who owns it, what can you do with it. And since this book was published, Kennewick Man was ultimately given back to the tribe and actually also studied a lot. So there was a lot of good that came out of Kennewick Man. It is still a gray area, you know, with a find that rare and that precious. Is it the best idea to rebury it in an unknown location ultimately, right? And we can argue that one all day back and forth. But so he sets the stage with the Kennewick Man controversy, but then continues by going deep into the way back of the earliest interactions between sort of natives and people from Europe, which is going to be, of course, Columbus. And from there, he talks about how Columbus and that time of Columbus really starts the idea of the noble red man versus the savage, right? Where you have native people, but they're seen in these extremes as good Indians or bad Indians, you know? And that comes from the very beginning. And obviously it's a cliche that has nothing to do with reality. He also brings up really early on, and I understand why he would do this, the idea of the vanishing American, meaning that much of anthropology, and I would say that anthropology as a discipline really started in like the 1880s or so, that anthropology was started with the idea that in America, that, hey, native communities are on their way out. They're not going to make it much longer. So we need to study these guys right now before it's too late, you know? And so the kind of that first generation of anthropologists working in the 1880s, the early 1900s, that was the focus. That was the impetus, right? And even more specifically, the idea was to interview the remains of current native tribes, but ask them about what did their grandparents do, you know, to try and get back to sort of before contact or early contact or this kind of thing. So that ideology was there early on. The idea that, you know, Indians are only good or bad and they're all going away, right? So we better hurry up. And obviously all that stuff is not true. And this is why I feel fine talking about something like this on the pseudo-archaeology podcast, right? David Hirst Thomas's book is not pseudo-archaeology. It's a great book, but he talks about some of these wrong-headed ideas from the early days. And he does it well, you guys. It's a kick-ass read. He's a good writer. He goes onward to talk about Thomas Jefferson as kind of the quote-unquote first archaeologist. And I've never been a huge fan of this. And it's not because of what Jefferson did. What Jefferson did was actually quite archaeological. He did kind of basically do scientific archaeology 100 years before it hit the mainstream, but he's such an outlier. You know, he's this obviously president of the United States, wealthy person, has huge land, He has slaves who he uses to help him dig a native mound basically on his property. But we can say he did record the excavations in a very scientific manner. So I like talking about Jefferson in this context, but I don't like the label of first archaeologist. It's such an outside story. But David Hurst Thomas talks about that, right? And that's cool. It's a great thing to add in. And we can start to see some of the two sides of archaeology versus the native community, meaning that, oh, do Indian groups see Jefferson as like the first looter, you know, or this kind of thing? And it's a nuanced situation. You know, with that, I think we're going to take a break and then we're going to come back to this in just a minute. Hello, and welcome back to the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast, episode 181. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Kinkella, and we are continuing talking about the book Skull Wars, which I am retiring after over 20 years of honorable service. So we talked about how the book begins and stuff. And you guys, I'm not going like chapter by chapter, right? I'm not going to give every single bit. I'm trying to just sort of talk about some of the major themes and some of the major points where we can kind of talk back and forth. The book continues with talking about kind of early anthropology and wrapping in scientific racism to it. Now, I do know that the term racism gets used so much these days that it's almost getting tired, but this is old school version 1.0 racism. You know what I'm saying? This is like real deal stuff. So the idea of in the earliest of anthropology, we're talking, you know, 1880s and before, like the idea of all people being either savages, barbarians, or civilized, right? And when you have a list like savagery, barbarism, civilization, of course, in 1880, it'll be like the darkest skinned people are savages. Then, well, the medium toned people are barbarians. Well, then the white people are civilized. You know, it has obviously nothing to do with reality, but they would, that was a thing, you know, during those early times. And also a very interrelated idea, the idea of social Darwinism. Now, when I teach this, I always have to be careful. I actually once got a student who I heard on the grapevine that somebody was saying that I didn't believe in evolution. And I was like, what? Because I mean, I teach evolution. I'm a huge fan of evolution. And somebody said, oh, yeah, Kinkella, we heard that you didn't believe in evolution. I'm like, what are you even? How on earth can a human even think that? And I was trying to figure it out. I'm like, how did that? I'm like, oh, because they heard me talk about how social Darwinism is wrong. Right. And so the idea here is regular Darwinian evolution. That's fine. Right. That's what Charles Darwin figured out in 1859. Evolution, survival of the fittest. You guys know. Right. Cornerstone of biology. We're all good with that. But the idea of social Darwinism is the racist idea, right? That, well, some human groups are just not as good as other human groups. I mean, you know, I wish them well, but they're just not that smart, right? It's that idea, obviously racist in its tone and has nothing to do with reality. So that's social Darwinism, you know? So Darwinian evolution, good. Social Darwinism, bad. At this time, you have a group of scientists, one in particular, you have Franz Boas, who comes out really in the 1880 or so. And Franz Boas is a complex character. I do not like when people just trash Franz Boas, because Franz Boas, love him or hate him, again, this is a complex character, as so many people are, as we are today. Are we also virtuous? Give me a break, right? We are complex characters that do certain things that really help people. And sometimes we make choices that are very self-serving. But Franz Boas is Mr. Cultural Relativism, right? He does give us the cornerstone of this sort of idea of anthropology, the idea of all cultures are kind of created equal, right? That we should not judge all other cultures on what we think, but just sort of look at them on their own merit. So this is a very open-minded way of seeing things. So Franz Boas gets massive credit for coming up with this idea that really focused anthropology on that central theme of cultural relativism. And there's all kinds of good there. At the same time, he was a grave robber. So you have to, So you have to take, you know, you have to take the good with the bad, the gray areas, which I love trafficking in. But he did grave rob like recent native graves and this kind of stuff. I will say that at the time, everyone was doing it, man, which is obviously not an excuse, but he would do this to study, you know, study the skeletons and this kind of stuff. And he wasn't nearly as bad as some of the other biological anthropologists of the time. Hooton's one of them. This guy was like, you know, he was Hooton, again, a biological anthropologist, was totally racist, totally like anti-Jew, like all of this. But he was a charming guy, you know, but not the coolest character. So I would be a little harsher on some of those early bioanthro people than I would be on Franz Boas. So you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater, you know. David Hurst Thomas goes on to talk about, of course, like the Sand Creek Massacre and some of the worst sort of native massacres of, I would say the worst time period is kind of like 1860s, 1870s, you know, in that vein. And he gives a very straightforward, factual account of them, right? These massacres are awful. And he doesn't pull punches, but he doesn't overdo it. It's like, here's what happened. Look at that, right? And it's awful. So as he makes us sad and brings us down with some of the worst of what the U.S. government did to Native peoples, then at least he brings it back up and talks about peopling of the New World. So he kind of brings it back and talks about the archaeology of when did the first people get to the New World. And this is where, as I said at the front, this is why I'm giving a happy salute and send off to Skull Wars, because this stuff is 25 years behind, and that's okay. You know, he couldn't know. But Thomas talks about the early finds at like Folsom, New Mexico, and Clovis, New Mexico. You've heard of Folsom, and you've definitely heard of Clovis, and the start of almost what's going to become the Clovis First situation, which is okay for the time. He talks about George McJunkin, the famous African-American cowboy who originally found the ancient Bison Antiquus fossils that had the Folsom Point in it. Right now, Folsom is a bit newer than Clovis. Just so you guys know, Clovis is about 13,000 years old, and Folsom, I think, is about 10,000. I could be off by a tick on that, but Clovis comes first. Interestingly enough, I'm recording this in late March, and just in the news, like 2 days ago, they're talking about the site of Monte Verde, which is also in Skull Wars. Monte Verde is famous as a site at the bottom of South America that dates really old, you know, pre-Clovis, pre-13,000, maybe about 14,000 by a tick. It's a tick older than Clovis. So you're like, wow, how can they get that far down to the bottom of South America and be older than Clovis? There's a new study out that maybe Monte Verde isn't actually that old. It's a complex argument. Dating ancient sites like that is, I believe the scientific term is, a horrendous bitch. So sometimes you get some bits and bobs that are very good. Like I've talked in other places. I think I talked on my YouTube channel about the site Rimrock Draw in Oregon, which is a quite new one that was found. And Rimrock Draw dates to like 18,000. And Rimrock Draw has really good dating and really good. It's like artifacts. It's a good one. So I am not opposed to being pre-Clovis, right? And I do think that there are good sites that are pre-Clovis. But Monte Verde, my point with Monte Verde is it doesn't matter that much whether it is as old as they thought at like 14,000 or these new dates where it's only 8,000. It's okay. You can still have pre-Clovis in the New World. So that's another argument for another time. But as you see, even to this day, 26 years after this is published, we're still arguing, you know, about peopling of the New World. And I'm guessing you guys have heard me say in the past, I think peopling of the New World is the singular hardest thing to answer in archaeology, the hardest question of them all, peopling of the New World. So, but David Hurst Thomas, you know, takes it on, talks about it, talks about the up-to-date science of the time. He talks about the ancient cultures, the earliest ancestors of modern native people all crossed the Bering Land Bridge. That is true. There's overwhelming evidence for that, be it DNA, be it the archaeology, you know. And so that's why I get pissed, like at the beginning where Vine Deloria says, you know, there's basically no such thing as the Bering Land Bridge, the sort of anti-science thing. I'm like, no, we just need to be honest with the data, right? We can argue back and forth on something like Monteverde, its actual age, but arguing that human beings never crossed the Bering Land Bridge is just freaking stupid and like a waste of everyone's time. Thomas also talks about the Salutrian. I've done that on this podcast earlier, right? The Salutrian, the idea that European peoples might have come to the New World a little bit, like way before the Vikings, right? When this was written in 2000, that Salutrian idea, I would say, had a 5% chance of being right. But in the intervening 26 years, I would say now it has about a 0.5% chance of being right. It's looking really bad for the Salutrian hypothesis. But that's how, you know, that's how science works. As you go over it, it's like the data for that is real sparse. After talking about, you know, peopling of the New World, he goes on and talks about some of the laws that were put in place for in terms of native communities versus the federal government. And there's so much here, you guys, that is even beyond the scope of this book and beyond the scope of this podcast right here that I will not go over at all, right? It's very complex. What I would say is you do have the Dawes Act is one of the most famous ones. It was from 1887, pushed by a woman named Alice Fletcher. Alice Fletcher was trying to help native communities, but the Dawes Act ended up being a terrible idea. It basically, it was an idea of trying to make native people into modern American citizens. And when you have ideas of assimilation like that, those tend to be the bad ones. And what you see is over the last 200 plus years, you see a movement between assimilation, make native people just like European Americans, and then a pushback of no, let native people do their own thing. And it goes back and forth, kind of generation by generation. Anyway, that's, he touches on that, you know, and talks about how that wasn't the world's best idea, because it wasn't, that was a bad one. He talks about actual, the bodies of native people. And this is where NAGPRA comes in. Again, NAGPRA is the law from 1990 that gives local native groups jurisdiction over human remains, right? And it's a misnomer that archaeologists hate NAGPRA, because they don't. I will say that NAGPRA has changed over time quite a bit. And the most recent changes in NAGPRA, the last handful of years, I'm not a huge fan of. But OG NAGPRA, I've always been a fan of. I think it's only fair, right, that native communities have jurisdiction over their cemeteries, you know, and the human remains of their ancestors, of course. He tells some more sad stories, though, about some Eskimos that an explorer brought back in like the 1890s. And there's this little 8-year-old Eskimo boy, Minik. Oh, man. And then he's brought back, and his dad, Kissick, is brought back. His dad dies, and like, Franz Boas steals Kissick's body for study. You're like, oh, Franz Boas, dude. But it's very sad. He also touches on Ishi. If you guys know the story in California of Ishi and Kroeber and all that stuff. And actually with that, we will wrap this up in a minute. Hello and welcome back to the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast, episode 181. And we are talking about the book Skull Wars. I thought I would just wrap it up with the last bits and bobs of stuff they were talking about. By they, I mean David Hurst Thomas. He continues with the mound builder myth. And oh my God, I don't think I've done this on the Pseudo-Archaeology Podcast. There's so many major ideas that it's funny. You know, I think you guys, I'm about 3 years in, something like that. 3.5 years? Good God, have I been doing it this long? And I would pride myself in saying, you know, I think I've hit all the highs, you know, be it Atlantis. You guys know, you can say it with me, you know, Eric von Däniken, you know, Eric von Däniken just died recently. I'll probably have to do a retrospective on Eric von Däniken. But the mound builder, stay tuned for a pseudo-archaeology podcast on the mound builders. This is a major one that I have not done my due diligence. The setup for the mound builders is when settlers first came, you know, to the United States and pushed west. As they crossed North America, they would come across these huge mounds. These mounds were not usually almost never built of stone. They were built of earth, right? They were earthen pyramids. And in the early days, the settlers were like, these were made by the Lost 13 tribe, or they were made by giants. These were the serious ideas that they thought. But by the 1880s, the Smithsonian that was just made, I think its first focus or one of them was to solve the mound builder myth, to be like, what are these from? And after a couple fits and starts, they figured it out, right? They were like, oh, these mounds were actually built by the ancestors of the modern natives who live here. So, of course, the settlers used to treat them with kind of reverence because they're like, these were built by ancient giants. But then when the truth came out, the settlers were like, wait, the Indians built these? Oh, let's bulldoze them. So a lot of the mounds have been bulldozed, destroyed, messed up. It's really sad. It's something that I think, if anything, doesn't get enough coverage over time. And, you know, I always think if we see like Egypt, like the museum in Egypt, and we see that they've done something wrong or they've messed something up, we have no soapbox to stand on in terms of trying to tell them to do things right, because all they have to do is be like, hey, how are your mounds doing these days, United States? You know, and the answer is terribly. There are a handful left. Monk's Mound is a very famous one, Cahokia. And there are other sites, but so many of them, you guys, have been just utterly destroyed. But that is a famous pseudo-archaeology story of the mound builders. And David Hirst Thomas, you know, takes us through that. It's a great story that you guys should look up on your own time or force me to do something on. He talks about Frank Cushing, who is an early cultural anthropologist who worked in Zuni Pueblo in the Southwest. He kind of switches focus to the Southwest for a while. He talks about Mesa Verde, which is a famous cliff-dwelling archaeology site, you know, and there's this Swedish archaeologist named Nordenskjold. He was working there in the late 1800s, and he was a decent archaeologist, actually, and he found a bunch of artifacts, and he was going to take them back to Sweden, and the United States was like, hey, you can't do that, and he was like, yes, I can. And the United States looked and realized there was no law saying he couldn't. So they were like, oh, shit, I guess you can. So because of this and other things, this spurned the Antiquities Act of 1906, which is the very first law of any real kind that protects archaeology. Now, without going into it, the Antiquities Act does not protect all of archaeology or all sites or something like that. It's very specific in its protections, but it's famous because it's the first, you know. And it starts the sort of idea of protecting the past. Near the end of the book, David Hirst Thomas focuses on more of the laws where, you know, we talked earlier about the Dawes Act, and the Dawes Act being this idea of assimilation. You know, native people here, you need to become one of us, assimilate to the Borg. And the Dawes Act, what it does, though, is it's like, hey, we're going to give each native family like 40 acres and a mule. But then there was so much land left that they were like, oh, but the U.S. government will take the rest. That's why it was so awful. It was a real bad one. He also touches, though, on the Indian Reorganization Act, which comes in the 1930s, the IRA. And that is, it's like an Indian New Deal. And the 1930s comes during the Depression era. What you see is how the U.S. treats Native peoples very much mirrors current cultural norms. You know what I mean? It does. So the Indian Reorganization Act mirrors that Depression era, trying to get people back on track, you know, that kind of stuff. And so it was, I would say it was largely a good idea, right? This, and it gives Native peoples more, you know, self-jurisdiction and that kind of stuff. But of course, after that, in the 1950s, just like because we're having the Red Scare, then you have an idea of termination where it's like, then it flips back to kind of how the Dawes Act. Again, as I said before, there's this sort of generational backwards and forward sort of thing. I will say that over time, in the last, I would say the last 50 years, it has generally gotten better. I think it's on a good path, you know, the laws that govern this and the choices that are made and sort of native buy-in, I think is, it's better, you know, it ain't there yet, but it's good. We want to celebrate the positives, you know, and not just dwell on the negatives, but look in that gray area world and look as a whole cloth in terms of how things are now. And they are on its way to being a better tomorrow. Thomas also talks about AIM, the American Indian Movement. This is what Vine Deloria is a bit of a part of. And there's plenty of things about AIM that I like. But the again, this idea of that anti-science thing, that's where I drop. That's where I'm like, nope, nope. You know, you can't just tell me you've always been here because you've always been here, you know, and it really an argument like that of like, oh, we've always been here. It's really, you don't really need it. You know what I mean? Whatever always is or isn't. And obviously science shows you that always is probably about 20,000 years at this point. It doesn't matter because they're first. They are the first peoples. They are the originals, you know, so that's what matters. And we're all on the same page on that. So the final point is David Hirsch Thomas does a great job of talking about what we call now pretendians or professional Indians, you know, people who are not native, but act like they are. And there are way too many of these, you guys, and they keep coming out. You've probably seen recent reports of various people, various known people in the media or in the entertainment industry who, you know, they say they're native. Tashin Littlefeather's a famous one. And, you know, there's a way too many others of people who are not native, right? They are not of this place, but I think this, a lot of times, this is a leftover from the 1960s kind of flower power movement. There are a lot of very young people at that time who were a bit lost and they kind of got into the whole quote unquote native thing, you know, and they were like, yeah, my great grandmother was an Indian princess, you know, that kind of stuff. And they just rolled with their lie and just kept going for decades and decades. And it's like, you're not, I don't know. I got no respect for that. I'm like, come on, man, just be honest. And it takes away resources from real native people. It's like, so these fake native, these pretendians will, even in entertainment, you would think like, well, entertainment, who cares? But they are going to win all the awards of like, oh, the award for native actor goes to this person. And it's like, yeah, except they're not native. So I'm not a fan of that. At the end of the book, David Hirsch Thomas also talks about some just fun kind of thought questions and ideas. The idea of kind of how much truth is there in mythology? You know, that, and he talks about certain myths that different native tribes have. And, you know, are these attached to actual historical events that happened long ago, like maybe 7,000 years ago? He has one about the eruption of Mount Mazama that formed Crater Lake. And I think that happened like 7,500 years ago, something like that. This is a long time, right? And there's a myth that vaguely goes with that. And, you know, is this knowledge from many thousands of years ago that has been passed down? I vote no. But that is a gray area that we can talk back and forth about. Again, you're not going to find somebody who likes mythology more than me. I love the art of storytelling. I'm very much into film and movies. I have a film degree, you know, and I respect storytelling and I listen to it. And I think it only colors in archaeology in a positive manner. But I don't take storytelling as any kind of scientific fact. I'm kind of a stickler on that stuff. Like, it has to be really good for me to go, okay, that has to do with historic events. And this is something I feel worldwide. It may be native culture. It may be the Bible, like, and anything in between, right? I'm a big fan of cold scientific data. So while I love these stories and think that archaeology is way more fun and better for it to include these stories, I'm not going to use them as scientific data points. Does that make sense? Right. That's how I feel about that. But I don't mind talking about it. And so, you know, he ends up with this idea of kind of science versus tradition or this kind of stuff. The idea that archaeologists and native peoples have to work together. And I'm fine with that. And I'm glad he ends it with that. But that is already happening and has been happening for a long time, right? It's, again, it's the part that doesn't get covered by the media, all the times where archaeologists and Native people work together, all the times when archaeologists and Native peoples are the only ones who care, you know, and be it big business or developers and stuff, that's the fight, you know. And I've had a ton of good experiences with local Native peoples, Native groups, whatever. And I think they've had a ton of good experiences with me, you know, because we're on the same page. And so we're going to end on a high note like that. Yeah. Yeah. You feel that? You feel that high right there? I think it's nice. Anyway, Skull Wars, man, even though it's old, read it. It's well written. And with that, I'll see you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to the Pseudo Archaeology Podcast. Please like and subscribe wherever you like and subscribe. And if you have questions for me, Dr. Andrew Kinkella, feel free to reach out using the links below or go to my YouTube channel, Kinkella Teaches Archaeology. See you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.